called Know My Word, a vision shown to me in 05, a terrified woman standing inside her home facing the front door, which was closed. On her face was sheer terror, as if sudden destruction was coming, and she was panicking. She held a can of black paint in one hand and a brush in the other. She began to frantically apply huge strokes of black paint on either side and above the door in an effort to gain some protection from the Lord. The vision zoomed in on her face, and I felt her fear. She was desperate. After praying about it, I understood that in the coming times, and even now, there will be many who scramble at the last minute to find favor and protection in the Lord, but their ignorance regarding His word will be a disservice to them. The woman was attempting some form of Passover ritual, as if it were something that she had once heard about but didn't really understand. As I watched her paint around the door, I thought to myself, where to begin? Passover was a one-time event to begin with. Secondly, she was using paint instead of blood. Add to that the fact that she was painting the inside instead of the outside. I thought, she's got it all wrong, all around. Protection cannot be obtained through any ritual. It's by putting one's faith and trust in the living God and through the blood of the Lamb, Jesus Christ. I heard the woman say, I heard the Lord say, I'm nervous. I heard the Lord say, know my word. I felt deep compassion for the woman, and I wanted to reach out to her and tell her this, but it was too late. She had no knowledge of His word. Destruction was on its way. I should also add this detail, that she appeared to be involved in voodoo, or just a combination of beliefs, like a hodgepodge mixture. Okay, that's that for that one. And come to find out, and I had no idea, but come to find out, I learned later that actually that is something that is a voodoo ritual. I don't know if it's voodoo, but it's something, some kind of black magic, whatever. They do that. Black paint on the door, like above and on the sides. And I like freaked out when I saw that. So I had no idea. People just scrambling at the last minute. And I can totally see that happening when stuff is evident, like stuff to wake up the dead starts happening, like, you know, like the worst hard-hearted people who don't believe anything. I don't know what it's going to take to wake them up, but eventually things are going to escalate to where it's going to be really hard not to believe something's going on. And it's going to be sad when people are like, oh yeah, okay God, I'll believe in you. It's going to be hard. It's going to be hard to sit down and study. It's going to be hard to sit down and learn. You can't absorb His word just overnight. You can't just glance through Scripture and get it all in your head and get it. This takes years. I've been walking with God for 20 years now, and I'm just now coming out of the dark in so many ways. Just, I'm still in the forest. It's like little sunbeams come through here and there and shine just enough light on my path to keep me moving forward. But if it's confusing for a person who's been walking with God for 20 years, I can only imagine what it's going to be like for someone who just rushes to Him at the very last minute during the chaotic times to come. And not that there's no mercy there. I mean, you know, gosh, God is so loving. He is so loving. It's kind of like Noah's Ark, you know, the door's closing, and the rain clouds are forming, and I would seriously stop mocking Noah. I would seriously stop pointing the finger at the Noahs of the world. I would really stop laughing and mocking the Noahs and look up at the sky and see those dark clouds forming. And it's not too late. Anybody can come to God, no matter who you are or where you're from or what you've done. It doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. He loves us all so much. It's just, it would just be a good idea to go ahead and, if you don't know him, just start learning about him now while you can and while we still live in relative safety and peace. And our Bibles are still legal.
I remember opening my eyes. I said, as soon as I got saved, God started just blowing me away. Stuff started happening, and I didn't know what was going on because I wasn't raised Christian at all. I didn't know about anything, and I wasn't saved till I was 17. I should probably start with a helmet incident, but I'll save that for another day. Right now, I woke up thinking about that cat, Priscilla. She was our beautiful family cat, and she was a long-haired Persian, actually. Not with a flat face, but she was a normal Persian. And she was just gorgeous and so sweet, and we just loved her so much. And one night, I was 17, I had just been saved. But I was still partying and stuff. It took me a long time to kind of outgrow everything or, you know, give everything to God. But one night I came home way past my curfew, and I didn't want to come through the front door because it would wake up my parents and I would get torn into. So I went around back and I rolled under the garage door. My parents kept it up a few inches so the cats could come in and out. I rolled under there and stood up, and the garage light was on, and I saw Priscilla, the cat. She looked dead, lying on the garage floor. She had blood coming out of her eyes and her nose and the corners of her mouth, and she was just dead. I mean, she was kind of, her mouth was kind of like a little bit open, her tongue was kind of flapping out, and I looked, and I could tell she was alive. Like, I could tell she was breathing just barely, but something was, like, seriously wrong with her. She looked like she'd been hit by a car and came in to die or something. And she wasn't responsive. I tried petting her and tried talking to her, and she wasn't responsive, so she was unconscious. And I wanted to run in and get my dad and tell him, but then I thought of myself, and I thought of getting in serious trouble, because he'd see how late I came in. And so, even though I had been out partying that night, I had been out drinking, I was probably stoned, I don't know, no telling what I had been doing. I was a new Christian, and I had been reading in the Bible, and I had been reading about healing, the stories of Jesus and his disciples going around healing everybody, and I thought, well, okay, that's what the Christian life's all about. I knew nothing, absolutely nothing about it. So anything I saw in the Bible about miracles, I didn't question. I thought, okay, that's just the way it is. So I had just read about healing, and so I thought, well, okay, maybe Jesus will heal this cat. And see, my dinginess has helped me with God, because I don't question things too much. So I knelt down and put my hands on Priscilla and closed my eyes and started to say the Lord's Prayer. And she didn't move. I just had my hands on her. I said the Lord's Prayer. And as soon as I said, "In Jesus' name I pray, amen," she opened her eyes and sprang to her feet and started purring and started... It was like, "Just kidding." And she just started, it startled me, and I jumped up. I stood up and stared at her, and it was like nothing had been wrong. She started weaving in and out of my legs, purring, meowing, you know, like cats do. I was just dumbfounded. I just stood up and looked at her like, "What?" And I looked down at my hands even, like I knew that prayer, I knew God healed her. But then I started doubting. It crossed my mind. I thought, oh, wait a minute. Maybe she was just sleeping, and maybe that was no big deal. And so I thought, okay, well, good for you, cat. And, you know, I turned it to walk into the house. But right when I did, my dad came out to the garage that second. I was just fixing to walk in, and he comes out. The house garage door opens, and he comes out, and he's standing there with a shotgun. And he I was terrified. I thought, I don't know, I didn't know what he was doing. And I said, what are you doing? And he said, what are you doing? And we went back and forth, and I said, what are you doing with a gun? And he looked down at the cat, and it was just so weird. It was like, he said, I'm coming out to shoot Priscilla, but she's up? And he was all shocked, and I was all shocked, and the cat was all happy, and it was kind of a really confusing moment. And I said, what are you doing? And he said, I was coming out to shoot her. It turns out earlier that evening, he went out to start the car. And see, the cat had a bad habit of sleeping in the fan engine of the car. And that evening, he went out there and started up the car, and he just heard like this thunk, and the engine stopped. And he turned off the car and everything, and it was the cat. She was knocked out, and he pulled her out of there, and she was limp and unresponsive and bleeding and all this stuff. And he called the vet, and the vet said, she was, you know, she had her brain knocked in or whatever, and to bring her in the next day to have her put to sleep. Like, the vet was like, watch her for a few hours, and if she doesn't, I mean, this had been going on, like, all evening. The cat would not wake up. So, apparently, my dad was coming out to shoot her himself, just to take care of it himself. And I came home just in time, and she was prayed for just in time. And he was like, she's up? And I looked at him and looked at the cat, and I decided then not to tell him that I had just prayed, because I would have gotten a lecture, I would have gotten yelled at. Those were some really hard years, and my mom became a Christian in 87. Her coworker witnessed to her, and my mom received Christ and turned around and pulled me out of school the next day and called me up to her work and witnessed to me. And it was like God just came in like a hurricane. He started with my mom, hit me, and then I turned around and witnessed to my little brother and sister. So this revival came into my house, even my house. I won't go into the way it was, but it was just amazing. Jesus made himself known in my family, and that's when a lot of trouble started happening. A lot of change in that household, and it was a hard time for everybody, for my parents especially. And I can't really go into it too much right here. But anyway, God saved that kitty and healed her. I saw it with my own eyes. And I never told my dad about the prayer. I didn't want to get a lecture for believing in God. That's what I wanted to talk about, but I just can't, because I love my dad. I don't want it to sound like I'm bad-mouthing anybody. But Priscilla lived 12 more years healthy and happy. And she had kittens with my other cat, Eddie Van Cat.
I wrote this on March 9th of 2009. It's called, Why Do Atheists Mock and Ridicule Christians? I had a conversation with someone recently. He's not a believer, which to me is a non-issue. I never considered it my business to discuss faith with him, or debate with him, or try to get him to see things the way I see them. Why? Because I'm related to him. I love him. I enjoy his company and his conversation. We can talk for hours and laugh. That is until the topic of, quote, religion comes up. He's pretty hostile about it. I shy away from discussing it, not out of fear, but to keep my own lid on. I think that if my own can of worms gets opened up around him, it's sure to escalate. For now, I just prefer to lay low. I like to listen to his point of view on things and it's educational for me to hear his opinions on why God simply cannot exist. Even though I disagree and know he's wrong, still I listen intently and try to see where he's coming from. I respect him and I show it, and no, I'm not talking about my father. He, however, has yet to master the art of giving the same in return to me, but it's okay. So in dealing with him, I've gotten a better perspective of where atheists are coming from. I understand. I also know that from a sensible human standpoint, the atheist point of view makes perfect sense. But I also have come to realize they simply have yet to experience the spiritual. This is something I brought up with my relative. He's really knowledgeable in financial things, investing, the stock market, etc., etc. This is a Bermuda Triangle area in my life. I have very little interest, knowledge, and understanding when it comes to finances. To me, it's as basic as this. Go to work, earn paycheck, deposit in bank, spend some, save some, period. I suppose this is why I am nearing 40 years old and still have the mindset of a teenager when it comes to money. I'm smart enough to realize it's due to my own ignorance. I pointed this out to my relative. I said, I have a feeling that if someone would have taken me by the hand and walked me through the ins and outs of money and investing and whatnot, and taught me how to be successful with it, and maybe even enjoy it, and let me experience firsthand the rewards of making a profit, then maybe I would embrace it and want to learn more. But as it stands, I'm an outsider in that realm. I'm inept. I've tried and failed to get ahead financially, so I gave up. And I get by on the bare minimum. He just stared at me and wondered why I was saying this. I told him, I have a feeling this is how you are when it comes to believing in God. You simply haven't experienced the spiritual or witnessed any miracles firsthand. You don't know him. Your sensible mind can't fit him into your own understanding, so you dismiss the whole thing. I honestly feel this is what's going on, big picture, with atheists. They don't get it, so they throw the baby out with the bathwater. To hell with it all, it makes no sense. After we had this conversation, the ridiculing tones from him ceased. But it really got me to thinking about it. Why are atheists so quick to mock and ridicule us? Does it make them feel superior? Do they actually think it helps their case? I just want to let it be known that it's hurtful and unnecessary. There's a way to debate and conversate without putting the other person down. If you really want someone to hear you out, watch your tone and treat them with respect. Hey, and that goes for Christians too. Never mind. I see this growing debate between atheists and believers. It seems to have gotten pretty nasty. I wonder if all the stress from the economy is making us all a bit tense. I got some good insight from the guy I was talking with. He was raised in a legalistic, religious kind of way, grew up in a small town. He grew up and moved on, and I think he's associating God with his sheltered upbringing. I get it. I understand why he views believing in God as small-minded and ignorant. The problem is, he's quick to make others who believe feel the same way. All I'm saying is, I think it's time to start listening just a little bit more.
This was called Tree Being Uprooted. June of 08, had a dream. I saw a strong, tall, straight tree, and the dream zoomed in on the trunk. And then I noticed that the tree was slowly uprooted. It was lifted up and out of the ground. And I saw the roots. And I was surprised to see how short they were, telling me that it was a young tree, but had grown strong and fast, and it was the size of an old tree. When I first saw it, it was a huge old tree. It's what it appeared to be, but come to find out, it was a very young tree. It had lots and lots of short roots. It looked like the bottom of an onion. You know how the onion has just this furry little tuft thing on the bottom, a bunch of little short roots? That's what it was like. It's like a whole bunch of roots, but they were very short. And then it zoomed in on the soil under the roots, and it was dark. It was rich and dark and fertile. being hidden and preserved, filled with possibility. As the tree was uprooted, I heard in my spirit, the climate will be much more dry. America, tall and strong, grew so fast, so many roots, people. And now, by God's hand, going to experience a great, quote, uprooting. Removal of its mighty stature, a great humbling over time, but not without purpose. Rich soil, spiritually speaking and literal as well. Beneath, okay, that's it for the little blog thing, but this is just me. Underneath the hard times we're going to go through, underneath the tribulation, underneath the humbling, underneath the uprooting, underneath God's heavy hand, there's purpose. There's rich soil that's going to be exposed. I sort of get the feeling this sort of has a few connotations to the whole oil thing and all that, but that's not the main point of it. There's rich, fertile soil. There's great possibility, a lot of room for growth that's going to be exposed when we have been uprooted.
Well, this is a dream I had. I guess it was at the beginning of November. I think it was actually two nights before the election. I dreamed that, and let me just say, I'm just going to tell you exactly what I saw. I'm not going to try to analyze it or, you know, put my own spin on it or anything. I'm just going to simply tell you what I saw and what I understand it to mean. And, okay. I dreamed I was sitting in a car in the middle of the car, like in the front seat, but in the middle. There was no one sitting in the driver's seat. But in the passenger seat, right, you know, right to my right, sat a certain politician. And he was attempting to persuade me regarding the gay stuff, like the cause, you know, the homosexual issues. He was, you know, an advocate for them, and I sat, you know, next to him. I was listening to his words, but I wasn't, you know, they weren't sinking in. I sat looking straight ahead. I kept my eyes straight forward. I didn't move. I just sat there while he very empathetically expressed to me the ins and outs. And I was suspicious of him because I knew he could have been in the driver's seat. But instead of taking that position, instead of taking the lead in this conversation, he sat in the passenger seat. He put himself in the passenger seat in a lower position to state his case. It was like a psychological twist. I didn't trust him. I knew he was trying to get me to see things his way, and rather than, you know, beating down with a stick, taking charge, telling me how it's going to be, he sat there trying to woo me over to his way of thinking from a different vantage point. And I just sat there and looked straight forward. And then, as he was speaking, I looked in the rearview mirror and saw a car behind us. And I turned around and looked out the back window, and it was my old friend, just someone that I used to be really good friends with, who is gay. And this person sat there in their car, exasperated, because they couldn't move forward. Because the car I was sitting in was blocking his car. And I realized we were in a traffic jam. I realized that my car was blocking the car behind me from moving forward. And I understood this dream to mean the obvious, that the presence of the praying Christians in America is blocking the gay agenda from moving forward, even though we see all these displays and, you know, don't be threatened, don't be... never mind, I said I wasn't going to put my own spin on it. Just the facts. The facts are, the praying church is preventing this thing from moving forward full force. That's not to say that's always going to be the case, but I looked straight forward. I did not look this man in the eye. You know, I didn't fight with him or argue with him or debate with him. You know, I didn't do that. I didn't get into it. I just kept my eyes looking forward. And it was just a reminder to me. Intercessory prayer for our country is everything. People think it doesn't do much, you know. Oh, what is my prayer? Like my vote doesn't count, my prayer doesn't count. You know, don't think like that. Because this was a very vivid and clear dream. The praying Christians, and just our stance on it, just not wavering. I saw something the other day on the news that made my eyes tear up. And that was in one of the parades. They were carrying a flag. It was supposed to be an American flag, I guess, but it looked like the American flag, but yet the stripes were rainbow. And this was a huge flag they were carrying. It breaks my heart. It's not just the homosexual stuff, it's everything. We're going to reap what we sow as a nation. We're going to reap what we sow. You know, that law gets passed, and it's free and clear. Kill all the babies you want. You know, completely strip the holy institution of marriage to saying, you know, it's no longer a man and a woman, God's original design. It's now, you know, whoever you want it to be. And, you know, surround yourself with porn. A complete mockery of God's beautiful gift that He's given to married people. And, you know, just keep fighting for these things. Keep fighting for your rights. That's what you're doing. You're fighting for your rights. One thing I do want to say is how lame it is when the homosexuals label Christians as haters. Actually, that's such a lie. In reality, they're the haters on hating on us. We're not operating out of our own opinion. We're operating out of the truths in the Bible that God has laid out. Guidelines for a safe, prosperous existence on planet Earth, to go by His ways. And we love God, and so we love His Word. And so we're just simply standing on what He said, We're not the ones who designed the universe. We're not the ones who have any emotional connection. We didn't invent these laws. We simply abide by them because we love him. And yes, we do agree with him. But they're not our... It's not our doing. It's God's doing. And we're just pointing to God. We're saying, no, we choose to obey God. And how does that make a Christian a hater? Nobody's hating anybody. Christians do not hate gays, you know. It's like, if anything, what you don't see is that we're on our knees praying for your safety and your well-being, and that God will gently woo you to him, to himself, so you can know his joy, so you can know the peace that's in him, so you can know the peace that comes with doing things his way, so you can be freed of the bondage. Christians are not haters. The haters are the ones pointing the fingers at the Christians, saying we're haters. You hate us because we're obviously against everything you're trying to do. That doesn't make us a hater. That's such a stupid term. This one is called, doesn't really have a title, but I saw it in October of 2007, and this was a dream. I was in a large public library. It was really official looking, almost as if I were inside a Capitol building or something. But I wasn't there to check out books. I was there for a doctor's appointment. And not only that, but I was made to go. As I approached the desk, I noticed a cop on either side of it, watching everything. I had a feeling of dread and of being controlled. I noticed that the side rooms were being used as examination rooms. It was also a hospital. It was like, quote, the medical place for everything. I sensed that we were all being regulated, and it was required that we all go there. As I stood at the desk to sign in, I looked up and saw that the ceiling directly above the desk was a dome, a skylight, and there were decorations going around the inside of it, such as eagles and ivy and American flags. It was pretty. But I remember thinking, am I inside a domed government building? But it was a library, or had been. Now it was a medical establishment. It was run by the same people as the ones in the other dreams. So what we have here is it looked like a Capitol building. It was open and, you know, kind of formal looking, and the big wooden desk was right like in the middle. And it was very scary, but at the same time, I knew it was here in our country, and I knew that it was our government, and, I have such mixed feelings about all this. I'm not closed-minded. I'm not anti-government at all. The opposite is true. I have a very special form of patriotism in my heart. It's not all about red, white, and blue, and fireworks, and Uncle Sam. That's not how I see it. I have a very pure and humble and basic love for my country. I love America, and I love our government, and I love law, and I love the way our government is established. See, we got to see the difference. Just because we see all the pollution, we can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. We can't just throw it all down the drain and say our government is this or government is that. We live in an amazing country, a beautiful country. A group of people on a boat, it was a fishing boat, and they were going to a new land. They were fleeing destruction. They had to use whatever form of transportation was available. It was definitely not a luxury liner. These were Christian... Well, no. The boat was full of people, but this vision zoomed in on a group of Christians that were on the boat. And I understood that they were not afraid. And they accepted loss. And they looked with anticipation at what was to come, totally trusting in God. and it zoomed in on a woman's face, and she stood at the front of the boat, and there was a look of sheer wonder on her face. She wasn't afraid. They were leaving America, and they were in icy cold waters.
Okay, this is like my sixth or seventh attempt at this particular one, and I just cannot seem to get it right. I don't know how to present this. I don't know. This will be my very first time to share a dream in this format, and I'm nervous. But this is obviously the next step. I have to keep going and stay on my... Okay, I'm just going to get to the point. I wanted to share a dream with you that I had a couple weeks ago. But in order to understand this dream, you need to know about another dream I had back in 2004. Because this dream I just had a few weeks ago is connected. In this this particular dream I had in 04 deals with the times to come. And I'm not going to go into that long speech on whether or not you believe all that, or that's not my deal. It's not my burden or my problem to convince anyone of anything. I don't have the energy or the brain cells to worry about that. My responsibility is just to share the things that God shows me, and regardless of anything. It's not exactly easy, but that's not your problem. I'm going to read this dream I had. Let me see if I can pull it up here. I've put this same dream on so many different blogs because it's very important. I feel that this dream sums up a lot. And those that are interested in this topic, it's a very broad way of putting it, this topic, you would know what this is referring to. And I'm going to read it here. I have to go kind of quick because I only have 10 minutes on this thing, so... Okay. It was back in 2004, I believe, when I had this one. I saw a shopping center that had been taken over. There were armed soldiers positioned upon the roof, aimed at the citizens. And there were shortages of everyday items, and things were being rationed. And I think the soldiers were guarding against looting. Then I saw more buildings, such as libraries and schools and such, and they all had been taken over, and they were all the same place, that's in quotes, run by the same folks. Next, I was in a place where people were being held against their will. I was on a school campus, I think, but we were fenced in, and there were more soldiers. People were miserable and frightened, and being made to work. I approached a person who was doing something at a table. I watched as he ground something into a fine powder, and as he worked, I sensed that he was grinding down human bones. As soon as I thought this, he looked up and looked directly into my eyes and said, "It is what you think it to be." Next, I was inside this place, this school that had been taken over, and it was somewhat of a prison. The classrooms used as cells and interrogating rooms. A frightened little girl came up to me, and I knew she was there alone. I held her hand and took care of her. As we walked hand in hand down a hallway, we happened to pass by an open classroom, and the door was partially open, just enough to where I could see that there was a man being tortured inside. He was on the wall. It was very disturbing, to say the least, even though it was a dream. I was worried that the little girl saw it too, and so I knelt down and put my hand on her little head and said, Heavenly Father, may your Holy Spirit protect this child. And may she not see these things here. And then the little girl looked up at me and said, I saw everything. I was taken on some kind of a tour. I saw more things until the very end when I was told to lie down in a bathtub naked and it was my turn to die. And they placed a gas mask over my face. The gas stank and I began to choke and then I woke up. One of the details of this dream was a woman. She was being held against her will, just like everyone else, but she sat and joked and laughed with one of them. And I knew that she had made connections ahead of time, and now it was serving her well. She was using her influence for the betterment of the captives, but in an underhanded way, by infiltration. She was a rare exception, and I knew that she was taking great risks. I'm just going to leave it at that. Usually I like to sum up my dreams and visions, but this one needs little explanation. Besides, I'm just a dreamer and all I need to do is share what I've been shown. Okay, that's it. Yeah, I'm a bit defensive, but hopefully I will outgrow that. Because this has not been easy to figure out what to do with this. When God first started showing me all these things years ago, I kept them to myself, and I wrote them down and hid them away in my journals and maybe told one or two people until I got further down my path and realized that I had a responsibility to share these things, regardless of the outcome, regardless of who thinks what or who says what. It's just whatever. You know, the beauty of my body not being strong anymore is I don't have the strength to care about the things I used to. So really this thing with my brain and my nervous system has helped me. It's just unraveled me, and I can't care. I can't get as nervous anymore. Why am I going into all that? You don't care about that. That's not your problem. See, I'm such a baby. I do hope to learn to be more mature and just get to the point. But if I got to the point all the time, I don't know if that would really be me, you know? I kind of like... Okay, let me see how much time I have here. Okay, I have just a few more minutes. Okay, I have to tell you about the dream I had just a couple weeks ago. It wasn't a dream, it was a vision. And I saw men laboring. They were bricklayers. They were building a little wall. It wasn't very high. It was only like two or three layers that they had built up. And I sensed that this was in the same place, the same place as the other dream. And I heard in my spirit, the bricklayers will be used in the making of the bricks. That's it. It's a very short and simple vision and very direct, and that was it. And I knew instantly that this one was connected to the one I just read you. And furthermore, I understand that this has a very heavy meaning to it, and I, you know, the man I saw in the first one, he was grinding down human bones into a fine powder, and I understood that these bricklayers were using contained some of this very same powder, and so I'll just let you put two and two together there. The message was, the bricklayers will be used in the making of the bricks. Yeah, you know, I think God has a really amazing sense of humor to show someone like me such heavy things. I gotta wrap this up pretty quick. Time's almost out. But We're in for some very difficult times. So wake up. Wake up, people. Just wake up and be aware. And I gotta stop it right here. It's about to run out. And that's all I know for now. Okay, bye.
It's in the early 90s, and I woke up one morning and got the paper. And I saw this headline, and it said, cannibal serial killer in Milwaukee, Milwaukee's monster, or something like that. And I looked, and I saw this picture of this blonde man in an orange jumpsuit. And, you know, of course, it turned out to be Jeffrey Dahmer. But I read the article that this man was just busted for, you know, killing people and eating them, and, I looked at his picture, and I had the burden come over me to pray for him. Seriously, I mean heavy. Like, intercede for this man. I was filled with compassion for him. And this wasn't an emotional thing. This was a real solid need, a burden to pray for this man, this soul. And I did. I prayed for him for weeks to come, and I actually sent him a Bible, and I wrote inside the, I wrote inside the cover about God's mercy and God's love, and how, you know, there's nothing new under the sun. There's nothing you can do that's too bad for God to forgive. And Corrie Ten Boom even said in her book, The Hiding Place, she said, it doesn't matter how deep or dark things get, God is deeper still. No matter how bad you can sin, no matter how evil you are or have been, God is deeper still. He can cover it. He can forgive you. His forgiveness knows no mercy, no bounds, no mercy. No bounds. There's no boundaries to His mercy. No matter how dark and evil, no matter how deep it goes, He's deeper still. And I wrote something to that effect in that Bible and prayed over it and I sent it to him. And I never told anybody. And I just prayed for him sporadically through the years. I just felt that this man, he's a child of God. Jeffrey Dahmer's of the world, Charles Manson's, you know, these are still children of God. Any being with the breath of life within them is a creation of God, and that deserves respect and compassion. And so anyway, you know, he ended up getting his own head bashed in a bathroom in a prison, and that's probably justice and all that. That doesn't mean God didn't love him. And I saw a documentary on him, or an interview. It was like a year before he died. I think Barbara Walters or somebody was interviewing him. And he said he became a Christian. And I know there are people all over who sent him Bibles and encouraging letters, you know. I know I wasn't the only one. I wrote this on August 25th, 2009. I have no regrets or apologies for my online shenanigans over the past 2 years. Today it occurred to me, this is what I enjoy, writing. Also, I have a burden to tell people how much God loves us all. I have a very early memory, so early that you might not believe this, but I have a memory of before I was even conceived. I've always had this inside of me. Even as a child, I remember standing in heaven, on the edge. That's how I sensed it. I was standing near the, quote, exit. It was to my right. I stood facing God, or an angel, or Jesus. I can't remember the face, or what the appearance was. I just know it was love, and there was light everywhere. And He stood there before me and said, "Tell them how much I love them." So I tell you how much he loves you in the only way I know how. I tell how he showed his love to me throughout my existence so far on this earth. I leave some things unsaid, hoping my voice will speak the loudest with the things I leave untouched. You know what I'm saying? No? Okay, well, I want to change the subject anyway. I'm sitting here this morning drinking my tea, fully aware of how the thought of God and God's love for us, and images of Jesus ready to embrace you with a big, fat, loving hug, can annoy the living daylights out of folks. How do I know? From personal experience with other people, listening to their reactions and hearing how they describe their annoyance with Christianity. One person I know has said, "Just the thought of Jesus makes me bristle with discomfort. I don't want anything to do with it." He also said that when Jesus is mentioned, he feels himself glazing over and his brain shuts down. So I know, and I'm aware of how uncomfortable my blog title is for some people to see. All right, this blog is called "He Loves You So Much." I forgot to say that. Where was I? Okay, so I know and I'm aware of how uncomfortable my blog title is for some people to see. That's why it's there. I had to get used to his love. I had to receive it and believe it. I had to learn to get comfortable with love and closeness and intimacy after coming from my family, where affection was a foreign word. Humor took its place, and after screwing up so many times and learning to accept forgiveness. I never mentioned this one. Several years ago, I had a dream. I was in my old room again, and Jesus sat on my bed like he did in the one where he spoke of restoring my heart. In this one, I sat beside him, and he hugged me tight, and I could feel a real love. It was protective and loving and sincere, but it was also foreign, a new experience, a new feeling. But at the same time, I recognized it. I was at home in that hug. Okay, I'm going to read this one to you. This has to do with Israel. This is a vision I had back in 05. And God is so funny with me. He uses pictures that I can understand. And in this one, he uses celebrities to represent nations. It's really a trip. And I'm just going to read it to you here. Okay, I'm reading straight from the blog here. No, I saw this in 06. I thought it was 05. Okay, I saw this one in 06. First, I saw a beautiful woman, a Jewess. She was radiant and perfect, but she was dressed in a bright red low-cut evening gown. It was pretty, but it was revealing way too much. She was pretty much exposed up on top. The Jewess was represented by the actress who played the nanny. Then I saw a row of people. They were dressed really fancy. It looked like they were sitting in the front row at the Academy Awards or some other fancy production. There were three people, an American actress, all cute and pretty and blonde, and she appeared to be like Meg Ryan or Melanie Griffith or something. Then a man who looked like William Baldwin. He sat in the middle. Then a European actress who looked like Nicole Kidman. I wasn't going to say who these people look like, but for some reason I'm supposed to. I don't know what they represent. The man who sat between them was, quote, with them both, sort of in between. A diplomat, maybe. I don't know, but I did notice the expressions on the faces of these people as they viewed the Jewess. It was envy at her stunning, unique beauty. I should also mention that she stood apart from the row of people. She was standing alone. However, the spotlight was on her. I watched this scene and felt compassion for the Jewess, which I understand to be Israel. At least I know that much. Oh, I felt compassion for the Jewess because she was exposed, and I prayed for her to be covered. And there appeared on her neck a beautiful, simple necklace. It had one large pearl on it, and although it was just a necklace, it seemed to do the job. It made all the difference, and she was no longer exposed. And I heard the Lord Jesus say, I am the pearl of great price. And I knew that that was his desire for Israel, to cover her. And I'm saying, try him. I'm saying, get to know him. Get to know my friend Jesus. He'll never let you down. And he's way cooler than you think. And he's got a great sense of humor. He's not a stick in the mud. He's your friend. And I just want to invite you to make that decision. You know, you may have been thinking about this for a long time, just unsure of which way to go, weighing your options. But I just want to say, some things are worth risking, and this is one of them. I dare you to risk it all, to step out on that limb, to step off that cliff, and let him catch you. When I was a stay-at-home mom, sometimes I got bored. One day I decided to make some food for a homeless man who lingered under a bridge. It was at I-20 in Hampton. That seemed to be a hot spot for beggars for some reason. I had seen this man several times, so I figured I should help him out. I made him a sandwich and put it in a plastic bag along with some cookies, a cold drink, and a Tupperware container filled to the brim with hamburger helper, and also a fork, a real one, and a napkin, and a Bible. I went and picked up my little brother and got him to go with me, looking for him. He was nowhere to be found at first, but after driving up and down the street and looking carefully several times, we spotted him. I made a quick U-turn, pulled over to the side of the road, and flagged him down. He cautiously approached the car, and I handed him his lunch. He looked suspiciously at me, then into the bag, then thanked me, and walked away. He didn't even smile. So later on that night, it hit me. He had no way to read his Bible. If he lives under a bridge, and since he spends his days begging, the only time to read would be at night, and there's a good chance he had no light. So I sat up and told Tommy that we needed to go buy a flashlight and give it to a homeless man. Tommy was quiet for a moment and said, Amy, what did you do this time? I told him about me and Joe feeding this man and how I gave him a Bible, but he had no way to read it. Tommy mumbled something negative and tried to go back to sleep, and I'm not sure how it all planned out, but within minutes we were in the car, Leah sleeping in the back, heading to the grocery store so I could go in and purchase a flashlight and batteries, just in case. So once this was taken care of, Tommy asked, Where is this man? I told him which underpass. He was in a really bad mood that night. A few go-rounds under the bridge, and Viola, I saw him. I told Tommy, There he is! So we pulled over, and Tommy rolled down the window and yelled out at the poor man who was staring at us. I think he recognized the car. Tommy said, Hey, did my wife give you a Bible today? The scruffy fellow peered into the car and looked at me, smiled, and nodded. Finally, a smile. I smiled back and waved. Tommy grumbled something mean under his breath and then said to the man, Here's a flashlight so you can read at night. My wife seems to think you need one. The man looked puzzled, took it, along with the batteries, said nothing, and walked away. Tommy was still not amused, but I was giddy all the way home. I sometimes wonder what happened next. Did the man ever read the Bible at night with the flashlight? I pictured him in my mind, sitting up high on the concrete, way up high underneath the bridge, leaning against a concrete column, maybe, taking in all of John's visions and revelation, and getting inspired and turned on to life once more. I had this brief dream about a year ago. I was in a car at a red light. I was waiting for the light to turn green, and I noticed that I wasn't all the way pulled up to the light. There was a good distance between me and the light, like maybe another full car length. In the dream, I did the obvious, pulled up all the way, and then the light instantly turned green. The lights are weighted. The pressure from the cars signaled change. I woke up and thought, pressure brings change. This was a comfort to me, as I am facing plenty of pressure in my life currently. But I'm reminded that stress, discomfort, and pressure are elements that bring about change in our lives. I'm trying to learn to work with it and not against it.
In my mind, I made my peace the best I could with this guy. And that was that. And I ended up marrying Tommy. And spent my years as a stay-at-home mom in a safety bubble. It was an escape from all the chaos, confusion I had been dwelling in my teen years. It was a quiet time of learning about God. It was a time of safety and protection. I was insulated. And Tommy took care of me and Leah. And it was a time of reflection, a time of sorting through things, a time of learning, a time of trying to make sense of everything. And God shed some light on some issues in my life that needed attention, and I began to realize just how broken I had been, how shattered I had been. I had some psychological problems after the abortion. I had some identity issues where I actually shaved off one side of my head, one side of my hair, threw away all my clothes that I loved and makeup, and not makeup, but jewelry and music and anything that was who I am, you know, I got rid of, and I tried to become someone else. I tried to throw myself away. I had a broken heart, and a shattered mind. And God slowly and gently started to show me my wounds. And it's really painful. And I'm getting to my point, believe it or not. The whole point, I'm trying to tell you how Jesus can actually literally heal and restore your broken heart and your broken mind. It's not just something you read on a card, you know, or a love note, broken heart. No, it's true. You really can be broken, and He really can put it back together. He began to show me the ways that I was wounded, going back to my teen years, and, you know, issues with my dad, and places of infection, spiritual infection, from the promiscuity and the dabbling with drugs, and dabbling even with a little witchcraft even. I didn't even realize, I didn't even take it seriously, but, you know, I'd play with a Ouija board a few times, and just opened up different spiritual doorways. And my mind just broke. I was sick in the head. And God began to show me, gently show me these areas that I was sick. And it can be kind of hard when you start facing the truth and when He starts giving you wisdom. Pray for wisdom, by the way, because He'll give it to you. My brother-in-law told me recently he spent the last 2 years praying for wisdom. That's been his number one prayer, and God has filled him with so much lately. It's like, Be careful what you ask for. When you start praying for wisdom, he's not going to shortchange you. So, while I was married in this little insulated safety bubble thing, he showed me these things, and it was really, really, really hard. It's like I had a minefield to work through. It's work. And to sort things out and realize what went wrong, realize the things that have happened and why you're this way and why you're that way and what areas need healing, cleansing and healing. It was really rough, and I did it on my own, but I had God with me. But the main thing that I could never seem to overcome was this feeling that I still had a broken heart from the abortion. I still felt that nothing could ever fix that. Nothing could ever repair that. And it's like walking around with this heavy, dark, black weight day in and day out. But I had heard stories of healing and restoration and forgiveness. And it was like just outside of my reach. I never could grasp this, and I wanted it, and I spent an entire decade in search of it. I never could get there in my head. I don't know what I was doing wrong, but I could never mentally or emotionally overcome the wounds from the abortion. And I prayed about it, and I knew I was forgiven in my head, but my heart was just broken from it. And I carried that weight around with me from the age of 18, all the way through my 20s, until the year 2000, after a lot more chaos happened, and now in 2000 was another quiet time for me where I was able to settle down and rest. One day, I was reading on a website that ministered to women who've had abortions. And it was a word of healing, and it was actually a prayer. It was actually a prayer someone posted. It said, God is going to heal you. God is going to bring restoration into you. Go to him and pray for restoration. It was like a prophetic word that really penetrated me. It was just, I was overcome. This was at night. I was in my mom's apartment. She was already in bed. I'm just reading this and I'm thinking, I want this. I want this healing that they're talking about. I want this restoration. I want this touch from God. I can't go on any longer carrying this weight around. I need to move forward in my life. I need to start gaining momentum and strength. I can't be carrying this burden around anymore. This broken heart. And so, being prompted by this prayer on this ministry website thing, I turned off the computer, and I got down on my knees in the living room and quietly said this prayer. I just quietly prayed to myself. I said, Dear God, please restore me. Please heal my broken heart from the abortion. I said, I want your touch. I want you to minister to me. I want you to heal me. Heal your servant so your servant can move forward. Heal me. And okay, I did that, and then I got up and walked back to the back bedroom to go to sleep. I thought that was it, you know. I thought, That prayer was it. My mom had her door open a little bit, and I just, you know, walked on past it and lay down and went to sleep. And that night I had a dream. And it was a living dream. It was alive. In the dream, I found myself, the year was 1988. I found myself in my bedroom. When I was a teenager, before I had the abortion, I saw my bedroom exactly as it was, and I actually have pictures of my room posted on another blog of at that exact time. In this dream, I saw those things. I saw all my old wild posters and decorations and jewelry and clothing, all these things that were part of me before I trashed them all, just trashed them and threw away my old identity. And I looked around the room, and it was a really happy feeling. And Jesus was there. He was sitting on my bed. And he pointed to this wicker basket. I used to have this wicker basket that I kept all my special things in, and he told me to open it up. And I opened it up, and it had a lot of my old things inside, and I was so happy. I was like, oh, I remember this, I remember this. And he was smiling. Jesus was sitting there smiling, watching me go through my things. These things I had thrown away. Trying to throw away myself. And he asked me to come sit down beside him. And he hugged me. And he said, I have a gift for you. And he held out his hand. And in his hand was half of a heart. And then I looked in my hand, and in my hand, I had the other half. I'm not sure exactly how this went, but I just remember there were two halves of one broken heart. I think it was on a necklace. He gave me a necklace that had the other half, and he put them together. And they fit together perfectly, and the heart was made whole. And he said, I am restoring you. I am healing your broken heart. And I felt joy. I felt real joy. And he hugged me. And when I woke up the next morning, I sat up, I bolted up and realized what I had dreamed, and I knew it was real. I knew I had spent time with Jesus. I knew. I bolted out of bed, and I walked into the kitchen. I walked through the kitchen to the dining room to tell my mom she was up, and I was about to start talking. I was about to say, Mommy, you are not going to believe what just happened. But before I could tell her, she said, where's Sonny? And I said, Sonny's not here. Sonny is my cousin. And during those years, he would come over a lot and hang out with me. And like one or two times, he would crash out there at the apartment. And She asked where he was. I said, he's not here. She said, what, is he asleep on the floor in your room? I said, no, he's not here. And she said, well, who was that walking behind you last night when you went to bed? I said, nobody. There's nobody else here. She goes, Amy, there was a man walking behind you when you went to bed last night. I wasn't asleep yet. I was sitting up. I saw you walk to bed, and there was a tall blonde man following behind you. Listened in awe as I told her the dream. And she shook her head and she cried and she said, Amy, God is with you. God is with you. I don't know if that was a guardian angel she saw or Jesus. I have no idea. I didn't see him. And I even asked her, I said, are you sure it wasn't the blanket I was carrying? Because I was carrying a blanket with me. She goes, no, Amy. There was a tall, blonde man following behind you. You know, and I had just prayed before walking past her room into the bedroom. I had just prayed for healing and restoration. This morning, as I was waking up, I heard in my spirit that it was time to share this. I know this is going to be an extremely long one, but I don't care. I want you to know that Jesus Christ heals broken hearts. He can restore your broken heart, no matter what has broken it. Whether it's been broken by outside circumstances or something you have done on your own, he can heal you and restore you. I'm here today to tell you, he healed a woman's heart of abortion. My heart broken too. I brought that on myself. And my God, my King, sat down with me in my room. And he saw my need. He knew I had thrown away my old identity. And he loved me enough to restore that identity back to me because he made me. He values who you are. He made you. He knows the things you like. He knows your favorite foods. He knows the details of you. And he values them. Because he values you. Don't you see? You're so loved by him. And if you're hurting and wounded, you don't have to carry that baggage around anymore. You can go to him and ask him for restoration. And he can heal your wounded heart. He can heal your wounded mind. He can heal your wounded spirit. He can heal your wounded body. He wants to. You don't have to beg him. He already wants to. He did this for a woman who had an abortion. Can you think of anything worse than that? To kill innocent life. Think about it. I'm here to say there is nothing under the sun that God's love cannot cover. There is no sin committed that God's blood, that Jesus' blood, cannot heal and restore and forgive. You can lay down your baggage And you can go to him and ask for cleansing and healing. And when he begins shedding light on things, it can be painful. Because a lot of us operate in denial because it's easier. I lived in denial for years about a lot of things. You know, it's like survival mode. To really, truly be healed, you do need to face the truth of some things. You need to go back and acknowledge certain things that have happened and ask him to shed light on areas of your life that have brought brokenness and spiritual infection. Ask for wisdom and ask him to show you things and begin to cleanse your wounds and to begin to heal you. Because there's a better way to live. There's a better way to live. You can be free. You can be free of the old pain. You can be free of the old wounds, the old baggage. These things that haunt you. You can shed them. And you can have new life. And you can be free. And you can gain momentum in your life, and you can gain strength. And you can begin to see things in a new way, and have new understanding. And with that comes new joy. And it's free, it's available to you right now. You don't have to fill your world with substitutes. And we all have a God-shaped hole in our heart, it's true. You don't have to fill your voids with drugs. You don't have to fill it with, you know, some people need constant noise around them, constantly the TV and the radio going all the time. You don't need that. You don't need to fear the quiet. You don't need to fear being alone. You can have peace. It's available to you. I think I'm done with this one. I hope you have a good day.